I'm very pleased to be able to introduce Charles Goodrich, our speaker today. Charles is the author of a volume of poems, The Insects of South Corvallis, and a collection of essays called The Practice of Home. Charles has also edited two poetry anthologies and an essay anthology entitled In the Blast Zone, Catastrophe and Renewal on Mount St. Helens. Charles has had a number of his poems read by Garrison Keillor on National Public Radio on the Writer's Almanac, which is pretty fun when you turn it on and you hear Charles's poem being read, which I have done. Charles now serves as the director of the Spring Creek Project for Ideas, Nature, and the Written Word. I would like to read a brief poem that Charles has written. It's called Ladybugs. Every January they reemerge, anchorites from within our walls, and cloister themselves on the upstairs window for a few weeks of fasting and travail. By day they wander the glass like desert mendicants, each bug nothing but a robe and a begging bowl. By night they huddle in the corner of the casement, a little heap of rosary beads, a handful of prayers incarnate. Winter being the season of doom, I have my own austerities to attend to. But mornings, when I find their eclipsed bodies on the windowsill, lovely and empty as little lacquered urns, I sweep them up with a feather duster and return them to the garden. His poems are delightful. I suggest you check them out at the library. Charles, a big hand, please, for Charles Goodrich.
She read that well. She read that better than Garrison Keillor did.
We should do this a little bit higher for
you.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. All right.
Can you hear him? Say something.
Yes,
him.
I'm going to start by reading a Wendell Berry poem, The Man Born to Farming. The grower of trees, the gardener, the man born to farming, whose hands reach into the ground and sprout. To him, the soil is a divine drug. He enters into death yearly and comes back rejoicing. He has seen the light lie down in the dung heap and rise again in the corn. His thought passes along the row ends like a mole. What miraculous seed has he swallowed that the unending sentence of his love flows out of his mouth like a vine clinging in the sunlight and like water descending in the dark. Hey, so, thank you, Deborah, and friends of the library for inviting me to do this. I have had a fantastic time in the last couple of months reading as much Wendell Berry as I could. And I probably would not have done that nonstop like that without an assignment. So it was really, really, really useful to me to do that. In the past couple of weeks, just in the past couple of weeks, but pretty much all the time, I see Wendell Berry quoted in an incredible array of contexts. In the last couple of weeks, I've heard him cited by a fisheries biologist, an economist. I've seen several letters to the editor of the GT that quoted Wendell Berry. People at the co-op will drop Wendell Berry's name, and his name comes up in horticulture classes and in sustainability conversations. That's pretty rare for a fiction writer and poet. And so I can't really think of any other American writer who is cited in so many contexts. I think that is because he has such a penetrating critique of contemporary corporate industrial society. And moreover, he has an alternative vision, which you can really grapple with, you know, and he insists that you do grapple with it. He can't be dismissed out of hand with his agrarian vision. So I'm going to talk more about that as I go on and as I cite some of his particular works. Here's kind of what I wanted to do. The sense of my task today is to a couple things, is to convince you, if you haven't read any Wendell Berry, that you should do so, that it's instructive and pleasurable. And I want to give you particularly a couple of good ideas about where you might begin to do that. And if you have read Wendell Berry, I want to affirm your good sense and maybe make a few interesting comments that might relevant to your further reading of Wendell Berry. And I want to just provide a little bit more context of how Wendell Berry fits in our culture. And here's how I plan to go about it. I was going to do a very brief biographical sketch. I was going to talk a little bit about a few selected works of fiction and essays and make some critical remarks, my own responses to Wendell Berry. And I thought I would intersperse that at a couple points by reading a couple more poems, about which I'll probably say little or nothing, but just give you a little flavor of his poems. And I want to wind up no later than 12:50 so that we can have take some questions and have a discussion. I would love to hear your thoughts and observations about Wendell Berry. There will be huge areas of his work that I will not touch on. So that would be an opportunity for you to offer a corrective if I've omitted something important, which I will have. Who has read one or two Wendell Berry books? Oh, great. That's fantastic. Who has read five or more Wendell Berry books? Yeah, a few people. Is there anybody here who feels like they've read almost all of Wendell Berry? Okay, that puts me in a good position then. Very briefly, a biography of Wendell Berry. Wendell Berry will celebrate his 75th birthday on August 5th, born in 1934, in Henry County, Kentucky, where he continues to live. His father was a lawyer and a tobacco farmer. There are farmers galore and several interesting lawyers in Wendell Berry's fiction. He married his wife, Tanya Amix, in 1957, so they just celebrated their 50th. He was educated at the University of Kentucky, where he got a bachelor's and a master's. And then, significantly, he went off to one of the premier writing programs in the country. He went to Stanford University and studied with Wallace Stegner as a Stegner Fellow. He was in a seminar with novelists that included Larry McMurtry, Edward Abbey, and Ken Kesey. Could you imagine being in that seminar? That would have been in the mid-70s, I think. Yeah, that would have been intense. Maybe in the 60s. That would have been very intense. And he got a lot of work done while he was there because his first novel, Nathan Coulter, was published shortly after he got his MFA in 1960. In 1961, he got a Guggenheim and traveled to Italy and studied in Italy and France with his family. Came back and taught for a couple of years at New York University in the Bronx. His one significant sojourn into the East Coast literary milieu. In 1964, he returned to Kentucky and started teaching at the University of Kentucky, but he resigned in 1977 and has had other stints since then, but has a long quarrel with academia and has a trenchant critique of the way universities have been complicit with a corporate industrial models. And he has farmed ever since he returned to Kentucky. But he has, I think, paid the bills by teaching because he farms with horses on hillside land in Kentucky. And I think it hasn't probably done much more than pay the taxes. But serious farming, not hobby farming. He really has tried to walk his talk. He has two sons, at least one of whom still farms in that same area. You have a handout, I hope most everyone got one, that has the second page is unique, I think, among something that you could put together for American authors. I forgot to credit this because this is, I think this was a labor of love. Let's see if my, it's in the back. I found it in the back of his collected short stories, That Distant Land. Wendell Berry's fiction is set almost entirely in this very small community in rural northern Kentucky, of which you have a map. The Port William community, fictional community. The other map charts the genealogy of all of his, most all of his characters from his novels and short stories, and maps them onto one another so that you can see the relationship of place, geography, and community. Wendell Berry is sometimes compared to William Faulkner in the creation of this rich community for the setting of his works, and that is an accurate comparison in that regard. They're incredibly different writers in most every other regard. Faulkner's vision is much more gothic, full of storm and throng and hideous violent deeds. Wendell Berry's is mostly interested in the kind of everyday connections between people and the negotiations of moral dilemmas in a community that lives close to the land. But it's a pleasure to read a lot of Wendell Berry, and this is actually the first time I've done it. I'm more likely to read a novel and then say, well, that was cool. Now I'm going to go read some of John Updike or something quite urban and different. But this time I've really settled in and read a bunch of Wendell Berry's works in a row, and I confess it was very, very, very revealing. All these characters reappear. A minor character in a short story will appear as the central character of a novel, and all these characters in the backgrounds of all these works, and you learn little things about them, and you learn about where they work and their relationships to one another. And it was quite an experience to actually enter that community. So I would recommend that approach, to read a few Wendell Berry works in a row and see how they that works for you. I want to talk just about a few of the works of fiction, and I'm going to interweave comments about some of the short stories and a couple of the novels, because that's how Wendell Berry has done it. He has published a novel and then published some short stories and with some of the same characters, and then back to another novel and back to short stories. And I thought I would do that by concentrating on a couple of his more conspicuous characters. My favorite Wendell Berry novel is the first one of his that I read. That often happens, doesn't it? But I think critically it's acknowledged as one of his best also. It's The Memory of Old Jack. I paid $250 for it in 1978 or something like that. When it first came out and when I first read it. Memory of Old Jack is a particularly whole novel, I think, because it's almost entirely the memories of this old farmer in the community, Jack Beecham, who is long retired, lives in a boarding house in town. Through great effort and machinations, has seen his farm passed on to a young couple who he has mentored and who he believes in. So he's content in that regard. But he's a cantankerous old guy. He causes trouble for everybody in town. But mostly he's just revisiting his whole life in memory, sitting on the front porch in a rocker of this boarding house. And they're incredibly vivid. Something about that dropping into a remembered experience that's emotionally charged makes them almost surreal in their clarity. And Wendell Berry does that with great skill in many of his books, but never quite so hauntingly clear as he does in The Memory of Old Jack. The denouement of the memory of old Jack happens when Jack meets with his lawyer, Wheeler Catlett, and sets it up in his will that his farm, which is being farmed by Elton Penn and his wife Mary, will actually pass to them upon Jack's death. He's put it in his will that he wants them to be able to buy it. He doesn't want to give it to them because he doesn't want to enable them that way. He wants them to be able to buy it. And that novel closes with a sense of satisfaction that he's managed to do that. In a subsequent short story, and I really don't know whether Wendell Berry had this all planned out or not, in a subsequent short story called It Wasn't Me in That Distant Land, we find out that there was a loophole. And Elton was not able to so simply buy that farm, that Jack Beecham's wayward urban daughter has first claim on the property. She left long ago and wants nothing to do with it. All they want to do is jack up the price and sell it. And it's the jacking up of the price that kind of shuts Elton Penn out of the deal. I won't tell you how that comes out, but it's one of my favorite short stories in this collection that has many, many fine short stories in it. Barry's most cantankerous kind of character is a man named Burley Coulter. Burley is the wild son, outdoor hunter, always sowing off, sowing wild oats. Burley comes and goes in a lot of stories. He kind of anchors the wilderness end of Barry's worldview. He's the star of a couple of short stories in particular, which are among my favorite short stories in That Distant Land. One called The Wild Birds. As a young man, Burley Coulter had an unacknowledged affair with a woman named Kate Helen Branch, and they had a son out of wedlock. But Burley has never throughout his life directly acknowledged that son, Danny Branch. And the whole community kind of knows and kind of is complicit in Burley's unwilling. There are complicated moral reasons why he is. It's not really that he's afraid to own up to it, but it's going to have repercussions for Kate Helen and for Danny in this community. So for 30-some years, it's never acknowledged. But Burley's getting old. He's in his 70s, and he goes to Wheeler Catlett, his attorney, and says, I'm going to be gone soon, and I need to acknowledge that Danny is my son and put him first in my will. And which means that the other two people, his niece and nephew, will be displaced from first place in the will. And so that causes some moral complications in the community. My absolute favorite short story of Wendell Berry's is called Fidelity. And it occurs some 10 years later than The Wild Birds. Burley Coulter is dying. He's suffered unspecified and terminal illnesses. And against his wishes and against the better judgment of the community, he has been taken to the hospital. He would much have preferred not to have been taken to the hospital. You may know people who feel that way yourself, and you probably know how difficult it is if you're going to try to set it up that way. And off Burley is hauled to the hospital, where he is, you know, hooked up to all the machines, and universally his family and friends that go to visit him are kind of appalled. You know, here he is. His humanity has been robbed from him. He's really just being kept alive against his will on life support system. Well, his son, Danny, decides that won't do, and he rescues or kidnaps, depending on your point of view, Burley from the hospital. He sneaks in and sneaks Burley out in a kind of a madcap scene and takes him back to his farm, to an old half-abandoned barn way out in nowhere where nobody but a few of the locals know it's there. And it's a beautiful, beautiful, tender scene where he takes Burley, and Burley is barely conscious enough to know where he is and what's being done to him, with him. And Danny proceeds to dig Burley's grave in the woods where no one will ever find it. He lines it with fieldstone. You can vividly picture it. It's articulately painted for you. And he, buries, I'll give you a little teary. It's a beautiful story. He buries Burley and covers it up so no one will ever find it. Meanwhile, the police have been after Danny, and they are waiting at Wheeler Catlett's lawyer's office back in Port Royal with the family sitting there going, no, I don't know anything about Danny. Danny, he said he was going up to Indiana or something. And they're just all completely stone-faced, and this young policeman is absolutely nonplussed. He has no idea what to do about this situation until finally he says, you know, if Danny doesn't show up pretty quick, you know, I'm calling the FBI, you know. And at the end of the story, and this doesn't depend on the drama, so I'm not going to feel like I'm going to give you away. This story is beautiful for the writing itself and the story. Danny walks in and says, here I am, what? and the policeman goes away in frustration, presumably without anything to pin on Danny or anybody else. I want to read a little passage from another short story called Are You All Right? It's a simple story. The river is rising, and Wendell Berry has numerous passages of floods. He has lived right alongside the Kentucky River. In the Long-Legged House, a nonfiction piece, he writes about a little cabin he has on the river and watching the river rise. In Jaber Crow, a novel, he has a long passage about a harrowing flood that Jaber walks through and around. Watching the river is a constant activity of Berry himself and his characters in his fiction. So the water's rising, and two characters, two old bachelors, Art and Martin Rowanberry, live back in the woods a ways where they often get flooded out. And Elton Penn wakes up in the middle of the night and realizes that they might be, he hasn't seen them for a couple of days. And maybe they're cut off and maybe they don't have any power. And maybe somebody ought to go check on them. So he calls up Andy Catlett, and they drive out a good distance and then have to get out and walk out to a place where the water has cut off the road, but they can see back to Art and Martin's house, and there's one light on, a little kerosene lantern. And what I wanted to do is quote, this is kind of archetypal vision of an admirable character, an admirable citizen in a Wendell Berry work. It's a portrait of Art Rowanberry. Art was the rememberer. He knew what he knew and what had been known by a lot of dead kinfolks and neighbors, too. They lived on in his mind and spoke there, reminding him and us of things that needed to be remembered. Art had a compound mind, as a daisy has a compound flower, and his mind had something of the unwary comeliness of a daisy. Something that happened would remind him of something that he remembered, which would remind him of something that his grandfather remembered. It was not that he lived in his mind. He lived in the place. But the place was where the memories were, and he walked among them, tracing them out over the living ground. I think that depicts his sense of the palpability of place for these people and how the place and mind were really interfused. So when Wendell Berry and when we talk casually about a sense of place, I always have this in mind, that who do I know that has that kind of connection with the memories and the physicality of the place. I'm watching the clock. Wendell Berry only wrote 30 books, so I'm not going to be able to touch on absolutely every one of them. One of his more recent novels, though, I will mention in passing, is a novel called Jaber Crow. Jaber is the town barber an ineligible, he calls himself an ineligible bachelor. a bald and awkward man who has this unusual relationship to his community is kind of the fly on the wall, the mouse in the rafters, you know, a man who's in the center of the public life but almost invisible there. So he hears all the town's stories. He's an absolutely memorable character, and he ends up, in the end, retiring from barbering and going to live in one of these, he returns to nature. He goes and lives in a cabin off the grid down by the river, and it has a beautiful, lovely resolution with the only woman he ever loved in his life. Totally unrealistic. If any of you have ever read Jaber Crow and you want to talk to me about Wendell Berry's portrayal of women, I would love to have that conversation with you. I'm going to talk a little bit more about it, but I would really rather hear you tell me how it works. But it does, it makes a nice transition to one of Wendell Berry's most quoted and recited and memorable poems, which I thought I would drop in right here, a poem called The Peace of Wild Things. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great blue heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I've come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. It's widely quoted, beautiful poem, isn't it? Not particularly typical of his vision, because his vision is really more of working people, you know. So this is a little respite from that morally complicated world which he loves to really dig into as people wrestle with their community, people in their community, and the earth. Wendell Berry is probably better known and more widely quoted. The reason he is quoted so often in the newspaper and in lots of other environmental contexts and economic and sustainability contexts is not for his novels or his poetry, but for his essays, of which he is, you know, a persistent and illuminating writer. He's a beautiful essayist. I learned so much about the language, how the language works, and he is particularly good about going into the place where a mistake was made and perpetuated by language, a subterfuge was made by changing the meanings of certain words, and he tracks those back to the source. In almost every essay, you'll find him doing some of that. I first read, Ben asked me when I first encountered Wendell Berry, I know that I read The Unsettling of America when it first came out in, I think, 1976, very important and still relevant book that Wendell Berry published with Sierra Club Books, which was unusual for a literary writer at the time, on the depopulation of rural America and the deliberate undermining of family farms by, at that time, the Reagan administration, although it had been going on for 200 years. He names names. There's a lot of specific stuff. He reserves particular revilement for then-agricultural secretary Earl Butz. But you can swap out the names, and it remains relevant for the most part, at least until a few months ago. We'll hope that we get a different story told now. It put him on the map with the environmental movement. His argument being that, as he said, the only thing we have to save nature is culture. And that was kind of to have that addressed to the environmental movement, which was focused on just kind of putting fences around wilderness areas, and then whatever happened on the rest of it, they didn't have anything to say about. He said, well, if we don't take care of our home places, we'll never be able to take care of wilderness. I mean, that they'll be knocking at the gates all the time. So it's a much more systemic view of taking care of every corner of the country. He talks about here for the first time, but throughout all of his essays up to the very most recent, he talks about the devaluation of work. He has an essay called What Are People For? And that our flight from labor has been cultivated by corporate interests, which have tried to create new consumers by convincing us that the work we thought we loved to do, really we hate. And so he has been the most articulate about that and steadfast in his critique of consumerists, called the transformation of citizens into consumers. So one of his most recent collections of essays is called Citizenship Papers, reminding us that we are multifaceted human beings and that our wants are not infinitely malleable, that they can be satisfied in community. It has been republished, still in print, 30 years later, a fantastic book. And I would recommend that you pick that up sometime. But the book I would recommend for you to start with, if you wanted to read some of Wendell Berry's essays, is a recent compendium called The Art of the Commonplace, The Agrarian Essays of Wendell Berry. The editor, Norman Versba, has done a great job of presenting these in a kind of thematic format, so you can see how essays from disparate times of Wendell Berry's career amplify themes as he goes along. And I'm just going to talk very briefly about a couple of the essays in here, but you can see my copy is flagged and marked up and has gotten a lot of exercise. If you've ever heard the term solving for pattern, that's a phrase coined by Wendell Berry for the process of finding solutions that solve multiple problems. So that he particularly has applied this to agriculture, but it applies in every field. That contemporary corporate agriculture has basically gone about saying that we have one problem, and that is we need to make more stuff. We need to grow more stuff. But if in the process of increasing yields, we've created a multiplicity of problems that never addressed and never thought about doing. So if we're going to take care of environmental degradation, the erosion of communities, the quality of food, habitat for wildlife and things like that, we need to solve for pattern. We have to have elegant agricultural solutions which address all those things simultaneously at the same time and minimize the unforeseen drawbacks of those. A very perspicacious short essay called Solving for Pattern. A more difficult and capacious essay is called, but it's central to all of his thinking, is Health is Membership. He said, Health is Membership. That's interesting. Health is Membership. Just to give you a tiny quote from it to give you a sense of what it's about, Wendell Berry says, I believe that community, in the fullest sense, a place and all its creatures, is the smallest unit of health, and that to speak of the health of an isolated individual is a contradiction in terms. I think you could think of examples that might support that notion. In an essay called titled Sex, Economy, Freedom, and Community, not to take on small issues, he interrogates the idea of freedom, distinguishing the freedom of individuals and the freedom of communities, and noting in a lot of examples how individual liberties erode ecological and community health. So that if I have the right to put any kind of poison I want on my lawn because it's my lawn, let's forget that it washes off into the ditch and then into the river, which is everybody's, my individual privileges are eroding the health of the community. In just every field, he'll examine this in economics, in agriculture, in education. How our liberties, which are aimed at protecting certain inalienable rights of individuals, undercut the health of the community, and that the community's health should take primacy. Many of the quotes I hear of Wendell Berry lately relate to his ideas around relocalization. He's probably the godfather of relocalization. He has an essay called The Idea of a Local Economy, in which he argues that it's the responsibility of governments at every level to protect communities and workers and land from the predations of corporate industrial economy. But in the absence of government doing that, it's up to the people to act and to protect their communities, and they should. And the only real defense is to nourish a local economy, so that you kind of take care of your own, make sure that you have grow as much food as you can locally, supporting local businesses, and that when we finally get a national government that's going to be receptive to those ideas, maybe we'll absolutely be able to grow that into larger scales, which can be applied, universally, that many, many localities can be self-sufficient and interrelated. A couple of books that I will mention just in passing because they don't get much attention. I looked in the library catalog yesterday to see how many books we had and which of them were checked out, and I'm happy to say that almost all of them were checked out. I think I have 23. And I think they're all but two were checked out. I don't. Maybe they had been checked out the day before, and maybe Deborah checked many of them out to have a display somewhere, and they never. And I know I have four of them, so that may be part of the cause. But anyway, that was great to see. Somebody was maybe doing their little homework for today's talk. But a couple that I don't even remember if the library has, but they're among my favorites because they're odd. And they're not so polemical, which Wendell Berry can be a little bit sometimes and a little tedious. The Hidden Wilderness was a book that was, I think, commissioned in defense of the Red River Valley Wilderness Area in Kentucky. I think one of the only wilderness areas in Kentucky. It's written in the mid-1970s. He has an essay in there called An Entry into the Woods, in which he records his physical transformation from driving on a highway out to the Red River Gorge and then getting out, putting on his pack, and walking into the woods. And he takes you through step by step how he relaxes and starts to hear things, but only gradually, this tension and cacophony of, being in a car, driving, having a life as a teacher at that time and things like that, only gradually quiets down. And I cannot now go on a backpacking trip or any kind of camping trip without remembering some of the very specific kind of physiological things that he first alerted me to, and that now I always watch myself go through these things and maybe go through them a little bit faster because of that. And another book I particularly love of Wendell Berry is called The Long-Legged House. It contains some of his most autobiographical writing. It's about his return to Kentucky after he started down a literary career. And was encouraged by many to live in New York and, be a full-bore academic and literary professional. And he reclaimed a little cabin along the Kentucky River that was an old family place run down on stilts. It was in the floodland called the Long-Legged House, and it has some wonderful essays about that. I'm right on time. I want to mention a few shortcomings in Wendell Berry's work, provocative ones, and I think maybe that they give critics a toehold to argue away more important issues, so I don't really want to spend a lot of time on them. We do definitely come back to them in conversation. But I will mention them in passing because they do irritate me when I'm reading Wendelberry too, as they have critics. He is pretty vehemently anti-urban and anti-technological. He got his ass in a ringer when he published an essay called Why I Don't Own a Computer. And it turned out that he didn't because his wife did all his typing. Did the feminists have a heyday with that? Rightly so. It was a really stupid essay, I thought. But he's been fairly unapologetic about it. So if you want to think about any kind of pragmatic efforts to ameliorate the problems of corporate industrial society, like homelessness, joblessness, military buildup and things like that, he's not a particularly good place to go. He's going to say most often the whole thing is screwed up. We need to go back to this point and do something different. And that's fine. I mean, he's done that better than anybody else. So I just go look for somebody else if I want to think about more pressing urban kind of problems. He can seem puritanical. There's not much eros. It's not overt eros in his writing. I would probably suggest, although you might argue no, I think it comes in some different places than we usually look at it. But it makes his writing sometimes seem a little staid and old-fashioned, and it's related to another part of it that I find difficult. Is he's not very good with women characters. I can't think of a strong woman character in Wendelberry's work. And I would love, again, if you could tell me that I'm wrong about that, or at least that I've overlooked something. That would be great. He mostly writes about this male world of farming. Now, I want to say this, that if you're a woman looking for a model of strong female characters in fiction, I'm not sure I could say, oh, go read Wendelberry. But what I could definitely tell you to look for is a male community that has compassion and that is very intuitive and caring, a male community of caring. Now, I'm not sure you could say, tell me a contemporary writer who has a really cool male community of caring. Not sure that you could name many, many people that would say that. So that would be cool. They almost seem to be two worlds, and the male community is well developed, the female community, although they're all given their due as strong. That Wendelberry thinks that all these women are strong, but we really don't learn much about them. It almost seems like, and there are some specific things in his essays that suggest that where they overlap, where they really intimately interact, is private. And that he's argued that there are really good reasons for that, and that it's too easy to cheapen and commercialize sex and all kinds of intimacies. So in that community, as you can imagine, and in Wendelberry supports it, that's private. In that regard, I would want to cite something that Ursula Le Guin wrote about fiction, contemporary fiction. Ursula Le Guin noted that most contemporary male fiction, but I think a lot of fiction, is what she characterized as linear, heroic storytelling. I called it missile fiction. What we learn in writing class at OSU is that you create a character that you love and then you just heap problems on them one after another, just raise the stakes for them. So you really care, and it crescendos at some kind of dramatic denouement, and then either everything goes to hell or it works out, and that's fiction. That's all mystery fiction, all thrillers, but a lot of contemporary, even literary fiction too, has a lot of violence and things that move the plot along. Ursula Le Guin contrasted that with what she called carrier bag fiction, in which, people just going along doing their things, and here's a little bit of this, and here's a little bit of that, was actually more like how it actually works, and is more satisfying at some level of values. And I would say that Wendelberry is more in that mold. So be prepared for that if you read his fiction. And, you know, give yourself permission to take pleasure in a different kind of experience, that it's slower and more capacious, and here's one thing and here's another thing. And I find it very, very gratifying. But the trajectory can be very meandering, like braided streams. How am I doing?
Just continue. You're doing fine.
Am I doing fine? Thank you. Okay, because I was almost... So I shouldn't skip this poem that I was going to read. Okay. All right. Here's a poem. It's from an early book, and I will say that my favorite among Wendell Berry's poetry is also his earliest work, this book called Farming, a Handbook, which is funnier than his later poetry. It's more cantankerous. He was a young man. You know, he had more piss and vinegar in him, I guess. This will give you a taste of a poem from that. It starts out kind of ironic, criticizing the mainstream mind, and then turns to his radical vision. It's called Manifesto, the Mad Farmer Liberation Front. Love the quick profit, the annual raise, vacation with pay. Want more of everything ready-made. Be afraid to know your neighbors and to die, and you will have a window in your head. Not even your future will be a mystery anymore. Your mind will be punched in a card and shut away in a little drawer. When they want you to buy something, they will call you. When they want you to die for profit, they will let you know. So, friends, every day do something that won't compute. Love the Lord. Love the world. Work for nothing. Take all that you have and be poor. Love someone who does not deserve it. Denounce the government and embrace the flag. Hope to live in that free republic for which it stands. Give your approval to all you cannot understand. Praise ignorance, for what man has not encountered, he has not destroyed. Ask the questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium. Plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest that you did not plant, that you will not live to harvest. Say that the leaves are harvested when they have rotted into the mold. Call that profit. Prophesy such returns. Put your faith in the 2 inches of humus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. Listen to carrion. Put your ear close and hear the faint chattering of the songs that are to come. Expect the end of the world. Laugh. Laughter is immeasurable. Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts. So long as women do not go cheap for power, please women more than men. Ask yourself, will this satisfy a woman satisfied to bear a child? Will this disturb the sleep of a woman near to giving birth? Go with your love to the fields. Lie down in the shade. Rest your head in her lap. Swear allegiance to what is nighest your thoughts. As soon as the generals and the politicos can predict the motions of your mind, lose it. Leave it as a sign to mark the false trail, the way you didn't go. Be like the fox who makes more tracks than necessary, some in the wrong direction. Practice resurrection. Yeah. So I'm going to conclude real briefly. Wendell Berry is often criticized, dismissed out of hand as nostalgic, you know, longing for a way of life that's gone and irrecoverable. And I asked myself, I was thinking about that as I was preparing for this, is he nostalgic? Well, in some cultures, I know in Russian the word nostalgia, it means something very serious and grave and heartfelt. It means I ache for home. It means I physically hurt for home or the homeland. And in that sense, if we took that, it's probably another term that's been cheapened. If we took it seriously, I would say that Wendell Berry, you know, evokes a kind of real, palpable, psychological and emotional nostalgia. He might say that we have never been home here. And William Carlos Williams' terms, it was Frost. Frost said, "We were the land. We owned the land before the land owned us." We have always been lightly plastered around. We don't have that kind of depth of mind that Art Rowan Berry has, which Wendell Berry thinks is what will, you know, lead to a long-term sustainable culture. So I would say I would try to rescue that word and say that Wendell Berry has something important to say about that. Let me read you one last quote, and we'll turn it over for questions. This is on your handout if you want to follow along. It's from A Long-Legged House, from an essay called A Native Hill. And talks about it, demonstrates how seriously Wendell Berry takes these matters and how he should never be dismissed out of hand on any of his criticism and things you could criticize him with. I began to see it was when he returned to live in Kentucky and re-inhabit his place against the advice of most of his professional colleagues. I began to see the place with a new clarity and a new understanding and a new seriousness. I walked over it looking, listening, smelling, touching, alive to it as never before. I listened to the talk of my kinsmen and neighbors as I never had done, alert to their knowledge of the place and to the qualities and energies of their speech. I began more seriously than ever to learn the names of things, wild plants and animals, the natural processes, the local place, and to articulate my observations and memories. My language increased and strengthened and sent my mind into the place like a live root system. I am forever being crept up on and newly startled by the realization that my people established themselves here by killing or driving out the original possessors, and by the awareness that people were once bought and sold here by my people, by the sense of the violence they have done to their own kind and to each other and to the earth, by the evidence of their persistent failure to serve either the place or their own community in it. I am forced against all my hopes and inclinations to regard the history of my people here as the progress of the doom of what I value most in the world, the life and health of the earth, the peacefulness of human communities and households. And here's the really important part, I think. And so here, in the place I love more than any other and where I have chosen among all other places to live my life, I am more painfully divided within myself than I could be in any other place. Is he nostalgic? No, he has sought the place that will keep him most uncomfortable, you know, by being in touch with his ancestors and by the trials that we've imposed on those lands and the people who've lived there. That's where he can be most effective and most alive, I think. That's what I have to offer. I would love to hear your thoughts, additions. Yes, please.
I've read the Men of Farmers and Merchant Manifesto a couple times to people. And plant sequoias for the millennium is what this town is not doing. They're cutting down the trees. They're putting in big buildings down in the river up on 23rd Garrison. And having grown up in cities, I don't really believe in urbanization at all. I find the automobile culture and urbanization to be energy sinks. You may disagree with that, but that's how I look at it.
Well, send Wendell a postcard. He'd be glad to know you're up here. Yeah?
Did you say that you thought Wendell Berry is anti-urban and anti-technology?
Yes. I'm sorry. Yeah, right. Thank you, Deborah. The question was, did I say that I think Wendell Berry is anti-urban and anti-technology?
So I guess I think Wendell Berry's idea is that there's an appropriate urban existence and there's an appropriate technology. I mean, I won't really go into it, but I think that essay you mentioned about why I'm not going to buy a computer, I think... he does a really good job in that essay, explaining his idea about technology. And in the The Way of Ignorance, is that? I can't think of the essay, but there's a good essay in there, kind of explaining how he thinks the city as the center should relate to the periphery.
That's a great point. The comment is that in a couple of specific essays in The Way of Ignorance and in the one about why I don't own a computer, Wendell Berry he unpacks that. He doesn't just throw it out and say, I'm against all technology. You know, he farms with horses, but he plows with a plow. You know, the plow was made in a factory. He articulates appropriate technologies. And I think I probably made a mistake, but I shouldn't really call him anti. He's appropriate technology. And I think I fed into the, it's too easy to call him anti anything. He will always repay, if somebody levels a criticism against him, he will go right into it and find out why it's more complicated than that. And you just did that for that, and I appreciate that. So, and he's very articulate about the relationship of rural areas to urban areas. He just happens to think that urban areas don't know how dependent they are on the rural areas, and the rural areas taking the shorts all the time. That's not really anti, and I shouldn't really say that. He's much more subtle and nuanced than that, and informative. So you'll learn about the relationship of rural Benton County to urban Corvallis, and be more appreciative of that. You know, he would be useful in every kind of setting. Thanks. Yes.
So I look around the room, and most of them are not my age or younger. I'm probably the only person here, which is, you know, that's great. I don't know if it's a function of like the middle of the day and on Wednesday, but there's college kids right over there who are probably free anyway. So I'm wondering how popular is Wendell Berry with my generation and younger?
I'd love to hear you to give us a little input in that. What?
I don't know. I mean, when Vonnegut died, he was like idolized in the college press. I was writing, and UWire just had stories. But I don't see very much writing about Berry in the college press at all. I graduated recently, so I don't know now.
Yeah, I think he's not. You know, he's not a cultural icon by any means, like Vonnegut was in many ways. And he's not funny, and he's not edgy like Vonnegut was. I can tell you that what is one of the most hopeful cultural things that I see happening all around me is the interest in farming and local agriculture on the part of college students at OSU. You know, I think people, I could introduce you to a half a dozen people who 5 years ago, certainly 10 years ago, would have been looking for a career in academia or maybe a lawyer or an MBA, and now they want to be farmers. And these are incredibly bright people who could do anything they want, and what they want to do is be farmers. And they know Wendell Berry. And even if they don't know Wendell Berry, he's the one, more than anybody else, who brought that to that place where those kind of values seem the most important to work for. So I know that among that segment in horticulture and organic farming at OSU, which is, you know, a burgeoning field, that Wendell Berry is well known and appreciated. But as a cultural icon, I don't think so much.
Do you think he's going to fade away? Like, he's 75 now, and there's a whole other, like, wave. His, like, omnibus coming out. There's been a lot of critical review of him. But do you think he's going to fade away when he passes on? Or is he going to get rediscovered?
Boy, you know, that's a dangerous thing to prognosticate on. I did think about that, and I would hazard to guess, I'm absolutely certain that this is just my own prejudice, that he will persist in way, and many other writers who followed fashions will fade away. Not as a literary stylist, so although he's a magnificent essayist and really has advanced the field in his interrogation of ideas and language and culture, but just in his return to perennial concerns that have been, you know, not fashionable in literary arts at all. So I think in the continuation from Horace to Ovid to Montaigne to Thoreau, Emerson, I think Wendell Berry is going to take a firm place in that tradition. Give me a report if you hear on that. I would love to. It would be, nothing would hearten me more to say that learn that, you know, recent college graduates or college students were reading Wendell Berry without being assigned. Yeah, Betty.
You don't have listed his book in nonfiction on Life is a Miracle, which is a quote from Faust. Or, I mean, not from Faust, from King Lear.
From King Lear, from Shakespeare, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, I thought your group there would find it, I mean, it's, it does go into religion and into, and he takes issue with E.O. Wilson on his Consilience book, and also, it's very provocative.
Yeah, Betty was just commenting on the on his more recent book called Life is a Miracle, and I listed just...
Oh, you couldn't put everything.
Yeah, I couldn't put everything, and I really didn't want to confuse people. I was just putting, that's my favorite. Yeah, Wendell Berry is a Southern Baptist. And I honor him for, you know, calling his own spiritual tradition to task, because he doesn't think, you know, that he's a monotheist. He believes in a transcendent God. And he doesn't think that the Christian church has, by and large, been talked about good stewardship of the land. And he goes and he has entree into those communities and goes to talk to them. That's not real resonant with my tradition, because I'm more of whatever I am. But so his Christian works really, you know, when he brings that up, I say, that's cool. I'm hoping he's getting a really wide audience. I'm not among them for that part of it. So that's why I didn't.
It's a provocative book.
Yeah, right. It is a provocative book. He really, and I have also heard questions about, you know, about he's. It's an angry book, and it's he goes really at E.O. Wilson's idea that all human knowledge can be organized under the realm of the sciences. That the humanities are really, really, really important, and the sciences are a little more important, and so humanities should get on board. He didn't like that, and I don't like that either, as much as I like E.O. Wilson. But I would have gone at it from a different angle. Ben.
I have a couple of questions, but I just wanted to respond to a young man who's asking about younger generation of people and how popular, as you use the words, a cultural icon. In our society, with the media and so forth, I think oftentimes we think that we associate, if somebody's not that well-known or popular among the whole society, that somehow something's missing. I think that the fact that you're here this today and experiencing, and I know, we know a few people, younger people who are very familiar with Wendell and his writing. And so, just like with Henry Thoreau, you know, for many, many generations, people weren't in contact with the values, his values, and so forth. I want to ask you the question about two of my favorite in the traditional media, favorite interviewers are Bill Moyers and Charlie Rose. And Charlie Rose is on later on, so everybody might not get to watch him. But do you think that Wendell would could possibly be invited to be interviewed on those kind of programs? And would he, from what you know of him, would he really generate an interest on a talk interview shows?
Could you hear it? All the way to the back, should Wendell Berry be on Charlie Rose? Has anyone ever seen Wendell Berry on TV or media, any kind of media? I meant to put it on here, and I did not. I'm sorry. But if you Google, you know, Wendell Berry, you'll get a lot of good websites. And one is called, if you Google Mr. Wendell Berry of Kentucky, you'll get a fantastic website that is just some probably – literature guy who has compiled all the resources of Wendell Berry, really fine resource, organized in different ways. And it actually has a video clip of Wendell Berry speaking. Wendell Berry and Bill McKibben organized a protest against a coal plant in Washington, D.C., two or three weeks ago. And he gave a little introductory address, suit and tie. Very careful speaker, read a poem, and walked away, you know, about 8 minutes. I guess maybe I'm the only one in the room who has seen a Wendell Berry episode on TV. Wendell Berry, after Unsettling America came out in 1970, I think, seven or maybe eight, was on Dick Cavett. You don't remember Dick Cavett, but everybody else. But, you know, he's, yeah, you've heard. And I was so excited by hero, my recently found hero, Wendell Berry, was going to be on Dick Cavett. It was awful. He's not a public speaker. He's a very slow, careful thinker. He was visibly, sweat was running off him. He hated being there, you know. It was painful to watch. You know, here's your hero, and he's melting down in front of a fairly kindly interviewer who's really trying to get him going. I hope you can't find it on YouTube.
Are you describing him as shy and possibly emotionally some insecurity creeps in?
You're giving me permission to speculate. I think he doesn't like the medium. I think he takes Marshall McLuhan's the medium as the message very seriously, and he has profound reservations about being there. And so he wants to be able to speak everything as thoughtfully and carefully as he does in his writing, and knows he can't. And so he's tongue-tied.
Given an hour, if he were on Bill Moyers?
Bill Moyers might be able to draw him out. Let's start a campaign to get Bill Moyers to interview Wendell Berry. I would root for that. Yeah. Right. Pat?
Going back to your bio of him, when he went to Italy early on, was it a Fulbright?
It was Guggenheim. Mm-hmm.
Guggenheim. Do you know, was he in the countryside in Italy, or was he in a large city? I'm just wondering what, you know, where that fits with his...
I do too. I didn't go down that trail. Didn't have time. My friend Clem Stark tells me that he has a copy of translations by Wendell Berry of the early French poet Ronsard. I can't find any reference to that, but that would have been what he was doing. I doubt that he was in a city.
But,
yeah, interesting. Yeah, please.
I wonder if you'd comment on something I see as a theme from the Stanford Writers Group, some of the writers that you mentioned that were with him, is that the land or nature is perhaps one of the primary characters in the book. And then your comment about his sort of lack of arrows. And I wonder, to me, again, some of those writers are using their arrows or for their love of the land or place or what have you. So is that a common theme that you...
That's beautiful. If you could overhear that, you know, that Wendell Berry, coming out of the Stegner workshop, many of those other writers that I mentioned, Larry McMurtry and Ken Kesey, manifest their eros in a love for the land. And you can see the land as a character. Absolutely, absolutely. The ending of Jaber Crow is just magnificent in its evocation of a person, of actually two separate people connecting with this place, and it is absolutely palpably erotic in the sense that the senses are fully engaged, that you know that there's a hyper charge of kind of animal life. So I think that's a great observation. Yeah.
And just another comment. Yeah. Your burial scene that so moved you, going out to the hidden place in the land. Edward Abbey was buried by his friends in the land that he loved, in a secret place that is not known to anyone, too. So that's such a dramatic coincidence, you know, that I wonder if something like that isn't a metaphor for becoming one with the land again, returning to the land.
Right? Neat. Neat. Right. A reminder, for if you couldn't hear, that Edward Abbey, talking about Wendell Berry's interest in natural burials and these scenes were lovingly evoked, a return to the earth. Many, many poems he says, I'm returning to the earth, you know, from a very young age. So it's, you know, it's thematic. It's not, and it's archetypal and mythic, not just literal. And that Edward Abbey arranged for his friends to take him out somewhere unknown and to be buried or left for the vultures, some people say. So among that community, Stegner kind of people and people who have a love for the land and it's a character, maybe that return to them is thematic and maybe also erotic or mystical or whatever, not to put too big of words on it, but central. Yeah, great observation. Thanks. Yes?
I heard on NPR that his poems are being compiled into a play.
I saw that too. Recent news that his poems are being compiled into a play. Did you remember the title? If you go to this website that I just mentioned, if you can find that, it has quite a bit of it has some recent reviews of it. What I was really excited about is it's must be, I think they're set to music or have a musical component, because the musician, a Scottish musician I really love named Malcolm Daglish, is the one who wrote this. And so this is going to be an amazing thing. I haven't been able to listen to it yet.
Just set to music.
Yeah, right. Would that be almost an opera or something? Because it's set up to music with a storyline. Yeah, sometimes those things don't. I was afraid to look because I was thinking, I don't know if this is going to work or not, but it's a really neat idea.
Will Mr. Barry help pick the poems, or do they?
I don't know. The question was, what kind of role did Wendell Berry play in choosing the material? I have no idea. I haven't learned about that yet. I'm excited. Yeah, but maybe, so let's see. Is anybody else who hasn't had a question that's got something they want to touch on? And then maybe we better take one more question and call it good. But I'm happy to hang around and talk. So, Ben, you want to?
Well, as I listened to the discussion about being buried anonymously, the thought that popped into my mind was whether that could translate into, in some way, to being non-egoic. That most of our society, most of all of us, are kind of connected with this feeling, insecure feeling, that we need to rise up and be somebody really special. And maybe there are certain individuals that don't have, in some way, that need, especially at their death, and, you know, go peacefully on and are buried anonymously. And that's really perhaps something we might all strive for in our lifetime.
I'm with you. Let's do.